I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders had decisive wins in New Hampshire yesterday as more than 500,000 voters went to the polls in the first in the country primary. Trump received 35% of the vote, with John Kasich coming in a surprise second. Bernie Sanders trounced Hillary Clinton with 60% of the vote to her 38%. These two outsiders, Trump and Sanders, were considered long shots when they announced their candidacies last year and have proven the pundits and the party leaders wrong, at least so far. The next big test is later this month with caucuses in Nevada and primaries in South Carolina. We asked Dante Scala to join us. He's associate professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire, co-author of a new book called The Four Faces of the Republican Party. And Dante Scala, we call you up about every 4 years to talk about New Hampshire and the primary. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here.
So what are the people of New Hampshire saying with their vote?
Well, they gave a very loud message yesterday. Yesterday was the single worst day for the establishment of both political parties up here in the history of the New Hampshire primary. I mean, we've seen upsets on one side or the other, but to have both party establishments, which didn't like, you know, weren't on the side of Sanders, clearly were not on the side of Donald Trump, to have them upset in this fashion. You know, as the union leader, the New Hampshire union leader, a famous statewide newspaper here, had gone after Trump again and again and had supported Chris Christie. And they were, when they reported the results today, they said simply, the voters have their say. And they certainly did.
And what's so interesting is that Trump and Sanders, while they might appeal to angry and disaffected and frustrated voters, they are such different candidates with such a different message to the country and to their followers. So what are Republicans saying? What are Democrats saying?
Well, Republicans are still saying at this point, well, it doesn't have to be Donald Trump. It could be still someone else. What was striking about Trump's support, though, it wasn't just, you know, disaffected working class white voters up here, but he got his fair share of college-educated voters, more upscale voters, and so forth. He earned a little more than a third of the vote here, which was a little better than the polls. Remember, he underperformed in Iowa. Well, he overperformed a bit here. And yet, there were, you know, one problem for the quote-unquote party establishment is just there were too many candidates in that right-center lane. John Kasich, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Chris Christie, Carly Fiorina. It was a pileup in that center-right lane. And while Donald Trump was basically, Trump voters knew who they were. They had a clear choice. If you didn't like Trump, you had a plethora of choices, and that hampered all of the candidates.
Although, interestingly, and I don't know, maybe you weren't as surprised as perhaps people down here in Pennsylvania to see John Kasich come in second. And while, yes, he wasn't close to Trump, he certainly did better, I think, than a lot of people expected he would do.
Yeah, I've been wrong about a lot this past year, mostly about Donald Trump. But at the end, I thought Kasich had a chance for a couple reasons. One is he and his experienced New Hampshire team chose a path of least resistance. That is, while others were competing to be the champion of conservative voters, Kasich softened his tone a bit and went after more moderate Republicans in New Hampshire. And there tend to be more here than there are in other primaries in the country because we're a northeastern New England state and so forth. So he was appealing to moderates, independents, even some Democratic leaners. Second, over this past weekend, while Chris Christie was taking out Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush was going after, there were a lot of negativity, a lot of negative ads.
Yep.
John Kasich was largely staying above the fray with a positive, happy message. Why are we Republicans attacking each other? We should all be talking about ideas instead. Voters like a positive message in a primary, especially when there's a lot of negativity coming from other candidates. And I think that helped him at the end convince some of those late deciders, and there were a lot of them in New Hampshire on the Republican side. I think that helped him get that boost at the end.
Well, I do want to talk about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Let me just play a small clip from Bernie Sanders' victory speech in New Hampshire last night.
We have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California. And that is that the government of our great country belongs to all of the people and not just a handful of wealthy campaign contributors and their super PACs.
And Dante Scala, just picking up on what Bernie Sanders was just saying there, and you talk about the party, what, elders, insiders, elite, they were not able to make any traction for Hillary Clinton, it seems like, in New Hampshire.
No, it's, you know, Hillary Clinton did about as well last night as she did 8 years ago when, remember, there was not just Barack Obama in the race, but also John Edwards. This time it was a one-on-one battle, so you would have thought that Clinton would do better than she did in a primary with multiple candidates, but she did just about the same. Clinton's supporters were trying to lower expectations for her over the past few days, saying that Bernie Sanders had a quote-unquote backyard advantage because he's from neighboring Vermont. Well, it is true that we share a border with Vermont, but most voters don't live out in the western and northern parts of the state. Most of them live in the southeastern part of the state. And Sanders, what was striking was the depth and the breadth of his victory, not just along the Vermont border, but from east to west, from north to south. Democrats, moderates, progressives, Hillary Clinton found very few groups among which she held an advantage last night.
And we'll be talking about this more as the hour progresses. But do you think, because New Hampshire is New Hampshire, frankly, you have less people than we have here in Philadelphia, largely white in many ways, and it certainly has that New England cast that I know so well since I grew up in New England. But do you think that really hurts her going forward, or time will tell?
You know, what would be concerning, I think, for her, both in the primaries but also in the general election, is how poorly she did among blue-collar, more moderate Democratic voters. I mean, her husband did very well among those voters a quarter century ago. She did well among those voters against Barack Obama 8 years ago. But last night, she lost those voters to Bernie Sanders, and it's a rare thing to see someone with such left-wing politics doing so well among blue-collar voters here in New Hampshire, who tend to be a little more establishment, a little more conservative, a little less willing to trust an outsider with big, you know, bold progressive ideas. That to me is the concern. It is true that she ran about even among registered Democrats or self-identified Democrats with Bernie Sanders, just a couple points behind. Remember, in New Hampshire, independents can crash the party. Those undeclared voters can participate in either party's primary, and Sanders just ran up the score among those independent voters. Clinton was far, far behind.
Dante, we have a couple of comments here. Let me read from an email from Greg, who says Trump's 32% was hailed as a decisive victory, while Hillary's 38% was a resounding defeat. Is it just that 32% in a crowded field is more meaningful than 38% in a field of two?
I think the caller makes a good point. It's not clear to me, and I've been a Trump skeptic for many months now, it's not clear to me that Trump will be able to expand his vote and become the front runner of the party. There were an awful lot of Republicans last night who rejected Donald Trump, even though he had a good night, no question. There were a lot of voters who were looking for experience as opposed to, say, an angry outsider who tells it like it is. The question is, will those, you know, center-right voters, somewhat conservative voters, reliable Republicans, will they consolidate behind one candidate, whether it's Rubio or Jeb Bush or John Kasich, sooner rather than later? If it's sooner, then that candidate would have a good chance to beat Cruz and Donald Trump. But if it's later, then this could start to get away from them, and party elites have an uneasy feeling that the base is not where they are, and they don't quite understand what's going on. They certainly didn't here up in New Hampshire.
And, of course, the question is, we won't know this for, 9 months, but just how predictive New Hampshire will be this year. Looking at past races, how predictive has your state been?
Yeah, we've been somewhat hit and miss. I mean, certainly we saw Barack Obama and George W. Bush suffer losses in the New Hampshire primary and then go on and win both the nominations and the presidency itself. So we're not necessarily fortune tellers here. Sometimes I think New Hampshire voters and New Hampshire elites come at it from two different places. New Hampshire voters are sometimes, they want to send a message, and it's important to remember that primaries are democratic with a small d institutions that are designed to disrupt the hold that party elites have on the party. That's why they were created in the first place. And as uncomfortable as it was for elites to wake up and see Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders this morning winning, voters had their say. They sent a message, and they weren't real concerned with what elites thought.
Well, and you have said that New Hampshire is, I'm quoting here, the wild child of American democracy.
Yeah, and I mean, it was. We're celebrating our 100th anniversary of the primary, and you know, it's getting to be middle aged as far as a political institution goes, and you know, we celebrate it, and it's considered venerable now. So for Donald Trump to come in, of all people, to crash the party and not follow the usual conventions was offensive to a number of people, mostly elites. And yet, you know, these primaries are democratic things. They're designed to give the people their say, as disruptive as elites might find them. And Bernie Sanders just ran a terrific campaign. I mean, he did not have any of the party organization with him. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Governor Maggie Hassan, the chiefs who had organizations were on the other side. But Sanders, he built it himself, and that's a classic New Hampshire story, to build from the grassroots up.
And, Dante, about 30 seconds before I have to say goodbye to you, are things now quiet? Has everybody left, and now the TV is quiet from the, $80 million in ads that was money in ads that was spent?
Yeah, I think the quiet is settling over the state, and people are packing up their audio and video equipment, leaving the Manchester Radisson downtown, and it's, I think we're looking forward to some peace and quiet before the fall elections start.
Well, I'm sure we'll be calling you later in the year. Dante Scala, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome.
And he's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of New Hampshire, co-author of a new book. It's called The Four Faces of the Republican Party. We will carry on our conversation after this very short break, talking about the New Hampshire primary, some of the results, what it all means, talking with Maggie Haberman of The New York Times and Laura Meckler of The Wall Street Journal. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. New Hampshire had been good to the Clintons when Bill won the primary and became the comeback kid back in the 1990s, and Hillary beat Barack Obama in a come-from-behind victory 8 years ago. Well, history did not repeat itself last night when Hillary Clinton lost big to Bernie Sanders, the self-described Democratic socialist. Donald Trump proved the pollsters right with a big win last night, with John Kasich coming in a surprise second. Here's Donald Trump declaring victory.
Oh, wow. Wow, wow, wow. So beautiful. So beautiful. We are going to make America great again.
Where have I heard that before? Maggie Haberman is joining us, presidential campaign correspondent for the New York Times, also a political analyst for CNN. And Maggie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Laura Meckler, national politics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Laura, same to you. Nice to have you back with us on the show.
Hey, nice to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation, talking about the New Hampshire primary, talking about some of the winners and losers. Maggie, I know that you were camped down at the Trump, campaign headquarters or victory headquarters in New Hampshire?
Victory night, yeah, at a banquet hall near the hotel where he was staying.
So what was that like?
It's about what you would expect. It was incredibly crowded, raucous, boisterous. You had people, you know, throughout the night. It was sort of the night of endless speeches because there were so many candidates between the Republicans and the Democrats. So Bernie Sanders talked for quite a long time in his acceptance speech. At a point, you had people in the crowd during the chant, "Shut up, Bernie," at the television so that Trump could come on. And Trump himself, you know, for a man who is given to sort of P.T. Barnum-like flourishes in his speeches and surprising people, his acceptance speech was very staid and very demure. You know, he did a sort of condensed version of his stump speech. As you just played the clip, "We're going to make America great again," talked about building the southern tier border wall, talked about the Second Amendment. He sounded relieved, and he sounded sort of almost like he might believe what had happened. To be candid, having covered him since the 90s, I can't quite believe what happened. But it was a very impressive showing. He outperformed his goals.
Laura, can you believe what happened?
I don't know if anybody can. It is amazing, both on both the Democratic and the Republican sides, that these people who are, you know, about as outsider as it comes to the mainstream politics, both won, and not just by a little bit.
But picking up on that, Laura, and it's been said before, I think it is sort of the mantra of the primary results last night, is these two outsiders that did so well among Republican candidates and voters and Democratic voters, of course, with the independents of New Hampshire folded in there. But they are very different candidates, Laura, it seems to me. And I mean, one is a billionaire. One is a Democratic socialist. What's the takeaway from Bernie Sanders?
Not only a Democratic socialist, but one who denounces billionaires every single day. So the two actually have, it's fascinating, a lot in common, but also very, very big differences. The takeaway from the Bernie Sanders victory is that, you know, Hillary Clinton is going to have to work really hard if this nomination is going to be hers. It was assumed for so long that this really was hers for the taking, that, you know, yes, Bernie Sanders would push her to the left on certain issues. Yes, he was exciting people, sure, but, you know, he's not a serious candidate. And in the end, you know, most people think that she will still pull this out. But he just showed her with just not just winning here, but by winning by such a large margin and really across demographic groups. However you slice the electorate through the exit polls last night, you know, he did well. I think she won over 65, and that was about it. You know, what it says is that, you know, that she has a challenge on her hand to find a way to excite the voters that he's exciting, and to reassert her what was once dominance in this race. I think that they've got some thoughts about how to do that, but it's not a good day for the Clinton team.
Well, how do you see it, Maggie?
I agree with that. I mean, I think that there were two. Hillary Clinton, in a sort of unprecedented fashion, cleared the Democratic field in the lead up to her campaign being announced. You had a bunch of people running against her, but you don't have a single sitting other than Sanders, and Sanders is not a registered Democrat. You don't have a single sitting Democratic governor, senator, any of the party's rising stars challenging her. So to watch this happen is sort of a remarkable thing. This is one state. She did win Iowa, but she won Iowa by a very close margin, and much closer than I think the campaign had expected it was going to be. And so it now becomes a question as to whether there's a trickle into Nevada and in South Carolina. I do think that the common denominator, to Laura's point, there's a lot of similarities between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. There's also a lot of differences. Right. You know, Donald Trump is somebody who is a member of the 1% who has managed to make himself the identifier of the 99%, which is bizarre. Sanders, you know, sort of truly looks and sounds like a working class person. There is a tremendous undercurrent of wanting an outsider and a tremendous, rail at the gates, get rid of the establishment feeling in both of these parties that you really did see in New Hampshire. New Hampshire tends to be a little bit more reflective, I think, of the mood of the country than the Iowa caucuses. And so what that portends going forward will be very interesting. Bernie Sanders is going to have a lot of money to keep marching on. And, you know, the Republican Party spent months assuming Trump was just going to go away on his own. That's not happening.
Well, let me play just a small section, about 26 seconds of Hillary Clinton's concession speech in New Hampshire last night.
I believe so strongly that we have to keep up with every fiber of our being the argument for, the campaign for human rights as women's rights, human rights as gay rights, human rights as worker rights, human rights as voting rights, human rights across the board for every single American.
And Laura, this is 2016, and one wonders what that Clinton name means in 2016 that it didn't mean back in the 1990s.
What does a Clinton name mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think for some people it's, and perhaps these are older voters, they feel a connection to the Clintons that goes back to his presidency.
Yeah.
But for younger voters, you know, that's grandma and grandpa.
Yeah, and it was a little surprising to me over the weekend that both Clintons, on more than one occasion, sort of reminded people about how old they are, in fact are, talking about how they have more. They have more yesterdays than tomorrows. I mean, they use that to segue to a message that, but for those of you who have more tomorrows, we're thinking about you. I thought it was a little bit of an odd choice. Mm. But in any case, yes, no, the young people are not locked into this at all. Another interesting thing, I mean, young people also aren't scared by the term democratic socialists. You know, these are not people who grew up under the the banner of the Cold War, do not feel that that's a scary term. In fact, there was a Boston Globe poll on over the weekend that found that in the Democratic electorate, 31% of people in New Hampshire considered themselves a socialist, not even a Democratic socialist, just straight up socialist.
Hmm.
Obviously, that was a spillover from people who identified that word with Senator Sanders, but I still think that was pretty remarkable if we're talking about generational gaps.
Well, and Maggie, it would be interesting if it's an experiment that we can't run, but if Bernie Sanders ran on the socialist ticket rather than the Democratic ticket, how well would he do?
I mean, as you said, it's an experiment we're never going to know the answer to. I think the strangest thing in Iowa, Laura makes a really good point, and I think one of the things that was off key about the Clintons in Iowa was that they were running this attack on him as a socialist. About 43% of the Democratic electorate is fine with that name. I think the other problem for Clinton for the last year has been that her team basically, ignored Sanders or hoped to ignore Sanders or assumed he would go away and couldn't figure out how to deal with him and how to go after him and how to draw a contrast with him. So when they suddenly pivoted to doing it, it was jarring. And that's a real issue. I also think that, she's only recently started finding what some people around her think is the best message, which is, Bernie Sanders will undo what Barack Obama did.
Hmm.
But she has had trouble sticking consistently with that message. It has tended to devolve to other things. To Laura's point, in New Hampshire, they not only were reminding people about how many yesterdays they have, but Bill Clinton was saying things that made very clear how personally he was taking this. The state sort of poised to reject his wife. He had a line the other day where I guess he showed up at some campaign event armed with economic charts, which is a very Bill Clinton thing, but he said something like, I'm glad to see Bernie Sanders is talking about inequality. I've been talking about it for 20 years. So Bill Clinton is not the candidate. And that in and of itself, I think, is a difficult thing.
It's a complicated marriage there. It sounds like, Laura, you want to add something to that.
Well, it was just funny. I was at a Bill Clinton event in Iowa where he held up a chart. It was like an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper that compared his economic record with Ronald Reagan's, which I found a little odd given talk about yesterday's. Half the voters are not paying attention to politics or not even born, when Ronald Reagan was president. So I think that, that struck me as an odd choice. It seemed like, again, like Maggie said, he's very interested in litigating his own record and pointing out what successes there were, but I'm not sure that's really what voters care about right now.
And of course, Sanders older than both of them. Let me just reintroduce our two guests. Laura Meckler, national politics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Maggie Haberman, presidential campaign correspondent for The New York Times, also a political analyst for CNN. And we are analyzing last night's vote in New Hampshire, the first primary in the nation. And as we all know, both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders had pretty big wins in New Hampshire. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and I can see lots of people want to join the conversation. Maggie, just a question to you, something that you wrote in this morning's New York Times. You say the roots of Donald Trump's candidacy goes back to that correspondence dinner when President Obama called him out about the birth certificate. It was also the weekend that the U.S. took out Osama bin Laden. But you say that was when, which was that, what, 5 years ago? That's when
2011, yeah.
Yeah, that was when Donald Trump began thinking about running for president. Expand on that for us.
Sure. So Donald Trump was already thinking about running. In the sense that he has flirted with running for president one way or another since 1987. You know, he did a fake version of running when he was promoting Art of the Deal in 1987. He did some very familiar sort of Donald Trump-like stunts. A lot of his issue positions are very familiar to what they are now on foreign policy. That's the area where he's been pretty consistent over many years. And then in 2011, he was thinking about running again, but it was not particularly serious. It was not handled particularly seriously. It was handled almost like a stunt. And that was when he was doing his birther thing about President Obama demanding to support the birth certificate. I have people out there looking. What happened that year, I mean, that was all sort of February to April. In May of 2011, he had already made clear he was not going to be running. He attended the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and he was at a center table in the middle of the room. I remember this very clearly.
Me too.
The president, this was right before the Osama bin Laden raid was warned of. But the president, remember, produced his birth certificate in the week leading up to Trump event, or the weeks leading up to Trump not running. The president had resisted doing that for a very long time. He didn't want to dignify the line of argument. But in his speech at the dinner, he put the birth certificate up on a jumbotron with sort of pounding music. The image of the birth certificate was literally throbbing on the jumbotron, and it was a gag, and I forget what the actual lines he said were, but the entire room was focused on the reaction of one person, and that was Donald John Trump, who was sitting in the center with his wife, not smiling. The entire rest of the room was laughing. Trump was livid and felt humiliated. He will never say that he felt humiliated, but having talked to him afterwards, he was clearly upset. I think that it can't be overstated how much Trump is driven by, in many ways in his life, wanting to be taken seriously and treated seriously, wanting to silence those who laugh at him, and remembering those who he feels did him harm. You see that real time on his Twitter feed all the time. Well, that was a serious moment for Trump in terms of fueling his desire to be taken seriously.
And as I recall, the president was basically saying, you know, I know you have really hard decisions to make about people like Gary Busey as the host of The Apprentice. I mean, he really shamed the guy.
He humiliated him. It was really, it was a blistering, bruising experience for Trump. And he will say that was not true. He will say it wasn't like that. It was like that, and he has never forgotten it, and it has been some source of energy for him.
Let me get David from looks like Flemington to join our conversation. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I believe the most determining factor for any Democrat who voted in or appreciates what happened in 1972 should be or is not having a repeat of George McGovern's experience.
And that was when,
and that's my very deep fear of Bernie Sanders being the Democratic candidate.
And David, thanks for calling in. And Laura, I've heard this from others as well. Of course, George McGovern, the anti-war candidate, who lost, you know, big time back in 1972. Some people worrying that Bernie Sanders will flame out the way George McGovern did.
Yeah, that's really one of the arguments, the core arguments that Clinton has been making overtly, you know, ever since, I don't know, at least a few weeks, where she's been saying essentially that there's too much at stake. You have to think about who can actually be elected. The problem with that argument is it's not very inspirational, basically, to say, yeah, I know you might like the other guy better, but, you know, he can't win. And it's such a pragmatic way of looking at it. And as is her whole campaign, is built on pragmatism, which is, you know, my plans are more realistic. I'm more electable. Those things very well may be true, both of them. I think she has a strong case to make. But it's just not very inspiring to people. And, you know, I wrote several months ago a story about how this race was really about, you know, heart versus the head. And I think that that's, you know, come to be true for sure, that is absolutely what's happening. And, you know, who wants to vote with your head when your heart is on the line? The caller does, and obviously some people do, but I think that for a lot of people that just doesn't resonate. But that is definitely one of the Clinton campaign's core messages.
Well, and we're almost up at a break here, Laura, but I'm thinking about all the disappointed Barack Obama supporters who believed in hope and change, and then the reality of legislation and the reality of D.C. politics raised its head.
Well, I mean, Barack Obama enacted a huge percentage of his agenda compared to what Bernie Sanders is likely to get, at least with the current Congress. I mean, you know, Barack Obama got his health care plan through. He didn't get a public option, and people were disappointed about that. But compared to the effort to try to get a single-payer program passed, I mean, I think that would look like a resounding victory.
Well, let's take that short break, then we'll get back to our conversation talking about what the voters in New Hampshire said yesterday or last night, giving both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders pretty big victories. Laura Meckler, national politics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Maggie Haberman, presidential campaign correspondent for The New York Times, a political analyst for CNN. Call us, 1-888-477-9499. Lots of comments here, Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'll try to read a bunch of those comments after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you're just waking up this morning, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders had big wins in yesterday's New Hampshire primary, the first primary in the nation. Ohio Governor John Kasich finished second among the Republican in the Republican primary. We're talking about, what do these victories tell us about the candidates, their campaigns, the electorate? Is New Hampshire unique? Will these results shift as the presidential race goes on? And again, our guests are Maggie Haberman and Laura Meckler. We mentioned John Kasich. Let me just play a small clip from his concession speech last night.
At a time when clearly changes in the air, maybe, just maybe, we are turning the page on a dark part of American politics, because tonight the light overcame the darkness of negative campaigning.
And Maggie, he sounds like a compassionate conservative.
He does. I mean, look, John Kasich ran in some ways a similar race to the one that was run by John Huntsman. In 2012, they happened to share some of the same results. It's a very similar sort of, I'm going to be an optimistic messenger for conservatism. I'm not going to tear other people down. Kasich really did hunker down in New Hampshire, and that was what he ran on. And their vote share, that of John Huntsman and that of John Kasich, are about the same. And I think that, you know, Kasich, a lot of people speculated that he potentially running to be vice president for somebody. I certainly think he has set himself up well. I don't think that's why he's done the race. I do wonder what his path is beyond New Hampshire. You know, he doesn't, I don't think, have a huge operation in South Carolina. And I think a complicating factor for him in the state, South Carolina politics are famously nasty. You are going to have, you know, all sorts of missiles coming from various directions of various candidates. Kasich himself were backing or involved in the campaign of somebody who ran against Governor Nikki Haley. And I think that could be very complicating heading into South Carolina.
You know, Maggie, we don't have the greatest phone line. It's kind of been deteriorating for this hour. Once you hang up, we'll call you back, and hopefully we can get you on a better phone line.
Sounds good.
Okay. Laura, let me just read a couple of tweets and email comments. So we have a tweet from Nate. He says, if Hillary can protect her minority support, then she will still prevail. We still have a deep love for the other first black president. That would be, of course, Bill Clinton. A tweet from Victoria. Clinton got as many delegates as Trump. Also, the Democratic base is 40% persons of color. Only three New Hampshire winners have been president. Bush won, Reagan and Carter. An email from Peter. Why is no one talking about the fact that Clinton won more delegates? Does it matter how many votes Sanders gets over Clinton? Does it matter? I mean, I guess in the final analysis, it is about delegates, not about the popular vote. But go ahead, Laura.
Clinton got more delegates out of New Hampshire?
That's what I'm seeing here, but I am not an expert on this.
Maybe that includes superdelegates, who are people who can vote for whoever they like. For instance, the governor or the senators, they have one vote just to themselves. So that may be what the tweeter is referring to. But I do think there's some good points that are made. Were made in several of those that you just read. I mean, the first point about minority support is really important, and that is very much what the Clinton campaign is focused on right now, is she's way ahead of Bernie Sanders among African Americans and Latino voters. You know, New Hampshire and Iowa, along with Vermont, I'll add, are among the whitest states in the nation. Nevada and South Carolina and the states that come after that are much more diverse. So if her support among minority voters holds up, she is in much better shape. The problem for her and the hope for him is that this win and this resounding win in New Hampshire will essentially change the way people think about the race, and that they'll give Bernie Sanders a fresh look, and perhaps that they'll like what they see. That's the concern for Clinton. Right now, if the demographic profile stays the same, she should be fine. So, you know, we'll have to see what that looks like going forth.
Let me see what Bob from looks like Harleysville has to say. Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I am a diehard Bernie Sanders supporter. But if it comes down to Hillary against a Republican, the only way I vote for Hillary is if she's against a Koch brother Republican. As far as I know, Donald Trump and Ben Carson are the only two that have not met with Koch brother organizations. So if it's Hillary against Donald Trump, I'm voting for Trump.
So you're knowing, of course, as you said, Bob, as a diehard Democrat, what is Trump's appeal to you? What does he say? What does he do that fits with your Democratic politics?
He's not taking Koch money, and he's not taking Wall Street money. And that's why I liked Ross Perot when he ran.
All right. Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Maggie, when you're a billionaire, I guess you don't have to take other people's money.
He is taking other people's money. This is a fallacy that is repeated constantly. It's one of his talking points that he's funding his own campaign. It is true that he has loaned his campaign about $12 million, but he also has taken several million in small contributions and in some max out donations.
Although, what can we say about Bernie Sanders? I mean, he talks about the average, and what has he raised more than Hillary Clinton?
Sanders outraised Hillary in January, and that was a jarring moment for the Clinton campaign, which had predicted for months that it could happen. But I think once the reality of it became apparent, I think that it was jarring in terms of what it means for his ability to keep returning to this small donor base and go forward. He has exceeded President Obama's record of number of contributions, which was an impressive record that 2012 in that race. You know, Sanders has the ability to keep going for a very, very long time. And the fact that he is able to sort of not only denounce her donations, but that he has seized on this issue or her critics have of her Wall Street speeches, that is a potentially devastating argument against her.
And she hasn't been able to, give it a kind of an effective either comeback or explanation?
Yeah, I mean, it's the problem is that I think the explanation is pretty simple, which is that she knew she was running for president and you know, she gave a lot of speeches ahead of that. Knew she was going to have a cutoff date at a certain point. But this was a foreseeable problem. You know, they knew that she was getting criticized even in 2013. Or at least eyebrows were raised about giving speeches at places like Goldman Sachs. And it wasn't just one speech before Goldman Sachs, it was a couple. And instead of sort of getting ahead of it, and this has been a problem with the Clinton campaign for the last couple of years, a similar problem in 08, instead of getting ahead of this stuff and sort of seeing what issues are coming at you, it was very predictable that the paid speeches would be an issue. It was very predictable that the email issue would become a problem. And instead of sort of figuring out ahead of time how to deal with it, they seem to wait until the issue is kind of upon them and then try to figure out how to get out of it.
Laura, let me ask you about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who spent a lot of time, it seems, a lot of political energy in New Hampshire, didn't do particularly well. And also in light of his debate performance, where he really went after Marco Rubio, basically calling him a robot. Chris Christie now back in New Jersey. I don't know if he's licking his wounds or trying to figure out what to do next. What do you make of his candidacy?
I heard somebody refer to his debate performance as a murder-suicide mission, and perhaps, you know, taking out Rubio but taking himself out as well. People who saw him last night said that he just looked defeated, deflated, and were predicting that his campaign wouldn't go on much longer. I don't have any inside information about that, but it looks like he has some hard decisions ahead of him.
And I think, Maggie, you talked about the murder-suicide performance.
I did, although
I was quoting you.
I think that, it was striking to me on the debate stage how negative Christie went. I mean, it was brutally effective. He clearly accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. It wasn't just about elevating himself, or sort of thwarting Marco Rubio, because we were pretty late stage voters deciding what to do at that point. It was also that Christie is very angry at the negative ads that the super PAC supporting Marco Rubio aired against him in December. He believes that it really helped halt his momentum. And I think what you saw was a level of genuine frustration being manifested as you know, an attack and an ability to fight back. I do think that Christie is a pretty tough task going forward. You saw that he went back to New Jersey today, said he was going to regroup. He canceled his South Carolina events. I'm not clear that he would qualify for the upcoming Republican debate this weekend. I think the criteria required you to have come in rankings in Iowa and New Hampshire that he just didn't meet. So he only has $1 million in cash on hand, which was not, and it'll be less by now. It's really hard to live off the land as a candidate once votes have actually started. So I think that New Hampshire was his best shot. I think that he's not going to continue on for no reason. And look, he's got a lot of people. My colleague Alex Burns has written about this. There is a lot of frustration in New Jersey about him not being around. And I think at some point he's going to have to go address that.
Let me read some more tweets and emails. A tweet from David. He says, younger voters aren't stupid. They use social media and go back and see the lies the Clinton have told. An email from 10, idealism is inherent in youth. We were all there. My concern is that Bernie's message, which many of us embrace, will screech to a halt when it hits the wall in Washington. Obama would probably confirm this. We talked about that earlier. An email, is the Pennsylvania primary now in play, and how does this affect the race for U.S. Senate, Attorney General, and Congress? The primary in Pennsylvania isn't until April, so much in play, I would say. Comment from a Jersey caller, the fly in the ointment seems to be that Hillary already has 500 committed superdelegates. Can they address this? Laura, can you address that?
The fly in the ointment.
Yeah,
I mean, I think this goes back to what Maggie was talking about earlier and the establishment support that she has. I mean, establishment support isn't just a phrase or a concept. It's actual votes at the convention next this summer. So she does. She is way ahead in the superdelegate race, and a substantial number of the votes do go to superdelegates. So now, of course, you know, some of us may remember in 2008 when she also started ahead with superdelegates, and that eroded and was not ultimately able to save her. As people switched to Obama and as he got ahead in the running total itself of delegates awarded through these primaries and caucuses. But she definitely is still ahead. I mean, I think that
you know, he won here. That doesn't mean that he's going to be the nominee, and there are a lot of reasons for that, superdelegates being one.
Let me read an email from Norma, and this is something we've actually talked about on Radio Times. Norma says, I blame the media coverage of Trump for his rise. The media has covered him as just a spectacle and have not held his feet to the fire for his dangerous comments. And Maggie, I think this may be targeted more at the broadcast media, especially TV, cable media. But if you go to some of those fact-check sites and you look at, you know, who's telling the truth and who isn't, when you look at his, it's you know, one, frankly, lie after another.
I mean, I think that this is where this is something that reporters hear a lot, which is reader criticism, saying you people are responsible for what we're seeing. Speaking for my own reporting, I have repeatedly highlighted Trump's incendiary comments. I have highlighted when he has said things that are not true. I have also done it with other candidates, but he is the person I've been covering more recently. I think there's a difference between whether it's being covered and whether voters care. And we have seen in this election, it has been unusual to the extent that you're seeing candidates telling just sort of outright fiction. It was the same with Christie, too. Christie was saying things, you know, he said he never supported Planned Parenthood, that he was misquoted when he said he did 20 years earlier. There were a couple of other things that he said that turned out, you know, that just were misrepresentations of his own record. Ben Carson obviously came under a lot of scrutiny for what he was talking about in terms of his inspirational life story. Carly Fiorina also was caught in some sort of exaggerations. So I don't remember another cycle where you saw so many candidates doing the same thing in that respect. But I don't think that it's that people aren't holding Trump accountable. I don't think that's really fair.
Are you saying, Maggie, people don't care? They just don't care?
I'm saying I think voters do not care. I think that particularly I think that the exit polling made clear. But so did the public polling leading up to the election last night, was that Trump supporters, you know, in poll after poll, you saw that his supporters were among the most committed. They were unlikely to leave him. And if they were unlikely to leave him back in July or August, and if they were unlikely to leave him after he called for a ban on Muslims entering the country, then I'm not sure what would have made them leave. And I don't think that us fact-checking him had much of an impact. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it. I think we are doing it, and we're doing it. We'll continue to do it. But I don't think that there's a correlation in terms of his popularity and whether there's been an assessment of his truthfulness.
Laura, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, we haven't mentioned the name Ben Carson except for the last minute or so. And, of course, a couple months ago, you know, he was leading among the Republicans. What happened to him?
I think he did. I actually think that may be a case where, you know, the scrutiny that he did come under right as he kind of peaked might have helped deflate his bubble a bit. You know, I think that there were just fundamental problems with his ability to connect with the Republican electorate. They did want in somebody on the outside, but he's maybe doesn't channel their anger quite in the same way that that Donald Trump does. You know, he doesn't have any obvious qualifications for the job, as far as I can tell. So, you know, he just sort of faded. I mean, I haven't really been covering the Republican race as closely as a Democrat, so you know, Maggie may have better explanations for that, but that's what I can tell.
Maggie, 10 seconds.
I think that a lot of Ben Carson's problem was that right after the terrorist attacks in Paris in November, I think he sounded like he was fumbling on foreign policy, and then even when he was making mistakes, he didn't correct them. Sounding strong. Trump did. I mean, I hate to say that it's that much loss, but I think that is a lot of it. I think Trump just projected strength. Carson did not, and I think it really hurt him.
Well, Maggie Haberman, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Presidential campaign correspondent for The New York Times, a political analyst for CNN. Laura Meckler, thank you very much as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. National politics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And I can see we could have carried on this conversation for the next couple of hours. Lots of interest, lots of comments, and we appreciate that. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.